Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. Today we'll be looking at the influence of reggae music on the diaspora and the development of the people in the diaspora in terms of a cultural identity and how, the part the music play in shaping that cultural identity. Today, my guest is none other than distinguished writer and commentator who has done a lot in terms of just writing about the cultural issues. While his background is in criminal justice, Dr. Basil Wilson received his PhD from the Graduate Center in New York and has been writing about the cultural development of Jamaican music along with issues of crime and violence also. He's currently a professor in the master's program of criminal justice at Monroe College in the Bronx. He was his former provost and senior vice president of academic affairs at John Jay. He's also was chairman of the African American Studies program at John Jay. And Dr. Wilson has been writing a weekly column for the Carib News, since 1998 to present. And he's also was a frequent writer where he did a lot in the area that we're going to be talking about with Everybody's Magazine from the 70s right through to the 90s. Dr. Wilson, welcome.
Good evening, sir. Thanks for inviting me.
As always, it's a pleasure. Now, what we'd like to kick off with is just taking a look, just to give people a background, your audience, a background as to how Jamaican music, a brief history of Jamaican music and why it is significant. Because many people look at what we hear today, the music of Marley, Tosh, Spear, Steel Pulse, and all the rest of them. And we take a lot for granted today, but it is interesting and important that people get a brief sense of how Jamaican music, the history of Jamaican music. Could you just talk a little bit about that, Dr. Wilson?
Well, indigenous Jamaican music is mento. I mean, there's a long history of mento. And, you know, in fact, sometimes when a tourist is coming in from Montego Bay or even Kingston, they might be greeted by a mento band. So there's a sort of indigenous imprimatur to the music. But as the country urbanized, we found that there was increasing musical influences coming from the United States. And in the 50s, coming right up to Jamaican independence, that American rhythm and blues from the South had a major impact on the Jamaican psyche, on Jamaican creativity, on the Jamaican love for music. Even today, in what is called, you know, the collectors' clubs, there are a number of Jamaicans who define themselves as collectors. I mean, many of them, what they collect is, in fact, early African-American rhythm and blues music, which had a profound impact on Jamaican urban society during the 1950s.
There's something I want to mention here, too, because in growing up in Jamaica, I remember a lot of the hit songs that we heard from the Elton Ellis's and so forth coming out of Coxon were actually remakes of American R&B music. The big individual whose catalog Mr. Dodd at Studio One dipped into was Curtis Mayfield. A lot of the songs belong to Curtis Mayfield. Now, Dr. Wilson, simultaneously with that, there was another development in Jamaica that was taking place in a socio-political sense and cultural sense of Rastafari. And I think it's important at this point to kind of just give us a little bit, just a brief synopsis of what the Rasta movement is.
Rastafari really started from shortly after the coronation of Haile Selassie in the 1930s. And it sort of dawned on a number of Jamaicans who were very much sensitive to the imperialism coming from British colonialism and the domination of British society over Jamaican life, that they began to identify with a black king, with the emperor of Ethiopia. And that movement was not that terribly significant until it began to mushroom around the late 1950s, early 60s. There are a number of things occurring in the late 50s, which is a sort of conjunction of activity taking place. One is there's a movement for self-determination that has energized political parties and, you know, the quest for independence. That is not achieved until 62. Then there is the expansion of black consciousness, which takes a religious form in terms of Rastafari recognition that Jamaican society exploited poor people and that the society, the social structure, was not predicated on justice. And so Rastafari then became a religion, a philosophy that was very much concerned about justice, about peace, about love, about the redistribution of wealth in society. But it wasn't a political movement. It was largely a religious movement committed to repatriation, a return to Africa, somewhat influenced by the Garvey movement, but in a religious form, and a commitment to return to Africa, to rebuild Africa. So that movement, that cultural movement of Rastafari, which emerged and became quite influential in inner-city communities in the late 50s and early 60s, also had a profound impact on the music.
Okay, so you're talking about a sort of a simultaneous parallel development here. But at some point, do these two phenomenons emerge? The music is happening on one end, and the social-political events are taking place of the black consciousness movement. Now, you think of somebody like Count Ozzie. How does he fit into that milieu?
Well, Ozzie, as you know, was a master drummer.
The head of the band Mystic Revelation of Rastafari.
Right. I mean, he was the head of the Mystic Revelation of Rastafari and died rather tragically in the late 1970s from an automobile accident. But even before Count comes on the scene, you know, you mentioned Curtis Mayfield and the fact that the early music tended to imitate / emulate much of what was taking place in American society. But you can see now not only the influence of independence, the influence of Rastafari, the music begins to become much more indigenously based. There's a time in the early music where Jamaican singers would imitate American singers, whether it was Nat King Cole or Perry Como or what have you. And they would come on stage and they would sort of try to sing like these noted American singers. I mean, the person who really broke that barrier was Laurel Aiken. And incidentally, Laurel Aiken came out of Count Ozzie, you know, came out of Eastern Kingston. And Laurel Aiken would not seek to sing like anybody else. He sought his own voice. And so that became a movement where people began writing their own songs, singing in their own voices. And that, in a sense, was concomitant with the movement for national self-determination. I mean, when you hear the music of Derek Morgan, even Jimmy Cliff, Prince Buster, a lot of the early singers then, Alton Ellis, Dobby Dobson, they began to find their own voices and to express themselves. Now, much of this expression took place in the form of love music, romance, etc., where the music becomes much more politicized and much more engaging the social structure is when the Rastafarian influence begins to take hold. And this is where Count Ozzie becomes a major influence. And, you know, and Count Ozzie made a song that is very popular now still, "O Carolina." And then a lot of songs that he made with Bunny and Skitter, which really, you know, was beating down Babylon. I mean, it dramatized the inequities and the social inequality that existed in American society. So Ozzie tended to personify that.
At what point was this?
This is early 60s.
We got independence in 62. And we had Scott. Talk a little bit about the relevance of Scott. Because I've heard the late Professor Rex Nettleford, Dr. Nettleford, suggested that ska was a celebratory music. It was a upbeat music that celebrated the independence of Jamaica. Talk a little bit about that as an art form.
Ska comes out of of Studio One. Before that, you had 2J and Blues Blasters, and they were, you know, they played also driving music. But one of the things that you saw, emerged during that period, especially around Studio One, was a lot of talented horn musicians who came together. Tommy McCook, Lester Sterling, Roland Alfonso, Dizzy Johnny, etc. And, you know, in fact, some others who used to play with Count Dazzy, that was Brother Gainier, and a lot of those people came out of Eastern Kingston. I once asked Tommy McCook why so many of the own players came out of Eastern Kingston, and he said that's where the clubs were. There were a lot of clubs in Central and Eastern Kingston having a lot to do with World War II and the sailors who came in sizable numbers when they came into Kingston Harbor. But
what kind of clubs were these? I mean,
these were dancing clubs. Some of them were brothels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you had a Dastro, you had a Vanna out in Linwood Road. But, I mean, there were clubs. And plus, you know, you had a place like Bournemouth, where Bournemouth
mm-hmm.
was really, you know, we had
Chuck-a-Molana,
those were mostly for sound systems. There were places where live music played, like Glass Bucket, Bournemouth, and there were places like Chuck-a-Molana, Success, Forrester's Hall, where the sound system actually reigned hegemonously. But when the Scatterlights came into being, I think we saw just a flowering of creativity, of musical creativity. And in fact, some of their music was borrowed from Monga Santa Maria. But they also made original music. And I think the musical genius within the Scatterlights was really Don Drummond, who incidentally had serious mental problems and had a sort of tragic incident with his girlfriend and also died in Bellevue Hospital. But Drummond was a musical genius. And, of course, Tommy was a little more advanced than some of the own players. And, you know, when you listen to Scatterlights music, you're really listening to the best and the brightest. And all of them basically came out of Alpha. It was Alpha Boys School, and there was a particular master there, you know, a musician who really trained most of them and really, you know, made certain that they could not only play music but read music. So that really was, in a sense, one of the high points of Jamaican music, the coming together of the Scatterlights. Unfortunately, the group was so talented and so contentious that they never lasted for maybe more than a year or so. But, I mean, they made telling music as music that it will always remain a classical form of Jamaican music.
Let's flip back a bit to the socioeconomic political situation, because Jamaica is probably about 90% of African stock, and there was a divide in Jamaica culturally and otherwise. Can we talk a little bit about the kinds of values? Because I'm thinking of growing up in Almontown, where I grew up, and I remember the sort of halfway tree, I think, was the divide between uptown and downtown. And the music we're discussing here is downtown music and is what we call regular folks music, because the folks uptown didn't necessarily embrace it or was a part of it. As a matter of fact, the Africanness that permeated the Rasta movement was something that was looked down upon. I remember as a child, Africa the Dark Continent and pygmies and savages, and that whole thing in the neo-colonial state. And why I want us to talk about that is to give a sense of the downplaying of the Africanness and the role it played. It eventually ends up playing in the music.
But
can you talk a little bit about that divide?
Yeah. But any analysis of any society must factor in class. I mean, class is self-evident. You can't get rid of a class in any kind of complex society. So Jamaica was quite a rigidly based class society, in which there wasn't a lot of upward mobility during that period. You know, the upward mobility would come through education, so therefore the people who had access to some of the better schools were able to, you know, move upward their mobile. But there, I mean, you mentioned geographically, and that is true. In fact, you mentioned half a treatment. You're a little younger than me. When I was growing up in Crossroads was the divide. You know, that's where you found a lot of middle class people. And if you went further up, you know, in places like Mona Heights and Hope Pastures much later on, and Constant Spring, et cetera, et cetera. That's where the middle class live. And of course, at the time, the middle class, in terms of the percentage of the population, was fairly tiny. Although during the 1950s, there was an expansion of the middle class, since there was an expansion in the educational opportunities. But it remained quite a rigid class society. And even today, there's a certain level of class rigidity in the society. And so what you're really pointing to is that much of the music came out of what I'd call sufferer communities, inner city communities, who in fact saw music as a form of liberation, saw Rastafari as a form of liberation, and in fact were very much involved in using music to protest the inequities of the society.
Now, let's go look at the upper class then. What type of music were they attracted to, and what were they playing, and even the radio stations at that point?
Well, you remember, one of the things I think that is amazing about Jamaican society is the variegated embrace of all music. You know, I mean, when you look at the collectors, I mean, it's just incredible. The interest in jazz, the interest in soul, the interest in rhythm and blues, the interest in reggae, et cetera, et cetera. That upper class was much more into popular music, in the sense that it was Frank Sinatra, Perry Como, maybe Nat King Cole, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, in fact, on a Sunday evening, I mean, you'd hear Nancy Wilson and some of the great...
Skeeter Davis and Jim Reeves.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a high taste for music. And, you know, and so a lot of that music was played. But also, by the time we got to the 60s, a lot of reggae music was being played on the radio. You had Teenage Dance Party, which was a live activity. And people like Laura Lee King and,
Owen Gray.
Well, Owen Gray, Jackie Edwards, I mean, you know, Clancy Eccles. They were in the vanguard of the music and became quite popular, you know, that would have quite a few hits, you know. Easy Snapping was a big hit. I mean, that, you know, I think he got 30 shillings for that, you know, that was made by Theophilus Beckford. I think Don't Beat gave him 30 shillings. Then you also had the groups, you know, the Techniques, Leroy Sibless's groups, then you've got the Paragon. So there was a tremendous amount of outpouring of creativity. That was just a joy to behold. And you mentioned the diaspora and the independence movement. That created a certain pride that, you know, Jamaicans, through their musical expression, were really able to really create something that, you know, the majority of the society was able to embrace. And, of course, you know, when you travel throughout Jamaican society, whether it is the inner city or the country parts, there's always music blasting. I mean, we're a country where music is omnipresent. And, you know, that's just an essential part of a culture, that musical expression.
Just hold on, stick a pin here, Dr. Williams. It's now 25 minutes after 4, and we're going to go to a commercial break, give the good doctor a chance to wet his throat and catch his breath, and we can pick up when we come back on the other side. So we're going to a commercial break.
The Keys 107 is proud to present State of Affairs with your host, Stan Smith. Keys 107. 07 in media partnership with Harlem's newest gem, the Mix Theater, are proud to present winner of 7 national and international film awards, Elsa, a film telling the universal story of a family in turmoil. A young woman's dream becomes an obsession in search for self, offering an insider's view of the lush island culture of Guadeloupe. Elsa is the first feature by a female director from this Caribbean island. Elsa opens shortly at the Mist Harlem, the newest venue for high-quality entertainment located at 46 West 116th Street. For ticket information on the World Wide Web, go to MistHarlem.com. This portion of The Keys was brought to us by Moon107.com. Moon 107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Moon 107 is an online retail store featuring women's and men's clothing and a gift shop. The woman's shop features stylish tunics, suits, and accessories and offers the well-dressed woman an outlet to find the perfect gift for self or for someone else. The men's shop offers classy French cuffed shirts for the well-dressed man. The gift shop offers organic skin, hair, bath accessories, and inspirational music imported from Africa, India, and Asia, as well as jewelry and accessories. Moon 107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Don't forget to visit Moon107.com.
M-A-U-N-107. M-A-U.
On Blog Talk Radio was brought to you by The Fluffs Present the Alphabet, now found in paperback, sporting a 5-star rating on Amazon.com.
Elsewhere on the base, a shimmering shape suddenly appears out of thin air, a shape that takes on human form, finally crystallizing into focus, revealing itself to be none other than
Stan Smith, as we return to State of Affairs.
And you out there in internet land on the World Wide Web, and those who are listening, if you're, we've covered a lot of ground here thus far, and we would like for you to call in if you have any questions or comments. And the number is 646-716-5971. That's 646-716-5971. And when you call in, if you have a question and you have a comment, just press 1. I'm going to go back to our guest, Dr. Basil Wilson, and we're going to pick up kind of where we left off, but we're going to look at the music. We've talked about the development of the music. Now, what I want to look at here, Basil, is the impact it had on the society. Because a lot of times, I think Mutu Baruka has described reggae as the poor people's gleaner, so to speak, or the poor people's star. Mm-hmm. And Jamaican music, I remember, as a child, meant that to a lot of us. Because if you wanted to know what was taking place in society, the music became that. I mean, there was a serious side of Rasta talking about, well, you need to know your culture and all the rest of that. But just day-to-day living, I'll give an example. I did an interview with the Gay Lads in 91 at Mr. Dodd, Cox and Dodd Studio One, studio in Brooklyn. And I was talking to BBC, and he said he had a particular song that is one of my favorites. It's called Most Peculiar Man. And I always liked that song. I never quite figured out where it came from. And he said while he was living, I think in Almonton and Woodford Park or somewhere or thereabout, there was this particular individual who was pretty strange, did some rather weird things. And he sat down and wrote a song of him. And everybody who lived in that neighborhood, when they heard that song, knew they were talking about him. Talk a little bit about how Jamaican music actually was basically a reflection of day-to-day living and how people saw themselves.
Well, yeah, the music comes out of people's day-to-day experiences. And I think the thing that I've found fascinating in understanding music is that if you go back to the time of slavery and you look at how African American slaves used lyrics to bring about their own self-liberation. In other words, they would use religion to ensure that the so-called master did not control their minds, or you know, they might have controlled their bodies, but they created a world that in which they would be free, that they would achieve freedom. And if you look at how the music evolves, whether it is jazz, whether it is urban music, and you see there's something quite similar occurring within Jamaica, that the music tended in many respects to personify the culture. You know, because music is an expression of culture. You know, and we saw the early music do much of that. I think the great transition in terms of that is the music of the Wailers. All right. I mean, when the Wailers started out, you know, you had tunes like Simmer Down, I Don't Need Your Love, great songs. You know. But I remember, you know, you can see that transition where I remember when Bob Marley made Soul Rebel and he made Soul Revolution, and then he gravitated to Rastafari and the music just began to take on a different dynamic. And, you know, that is, I mean, that didn't happen in isolation. I mean, there were people who had a profound influence on Marley's thinking. Not so much maybe on his music, but in terms of how Marley looked at the world. And so the music then tends to reflect a worldview. Music can also represent nothingness. You know, I mean, the people who make music and it's just about nothingness, or it's about something that doesn't give us much insight into how people live their lives. But I think the musical masters, the geniuses, really are able to capture the day-to-day life, the day-to-day misery, the day-to-day imagination of people and put that in the form of song and celebrate it in such a way that if we study the music, either, you know, either contemporaneously or retrospectively, we get a sense as to how people live, where people were, what they felt, and how they really express themselves.
I'm reminding of something that the great trumpet player Wynton Marsalis once said when asked about music. He said, "Art without a context is meaningless." And it sounds like, I think, what I'm hearing from you. But I want to flip back a little bit, because there's an album by Bob Andy that I think was pretty important, and it was called Songbook. It had songs like I've Got to Go Back Home, a whole set of songs that when put together and you listen to them, really kind of made, and that for me, even before I moved to Mali, you got a sense on Songbook that this was a man talking about, this couldn't be my home, this must be somewhere else, or I'd kill myself and can't get no food. He was talking about day-to-day living, but he was also talking about Africa and the history. So what I'm seeing, and this is me as a child, probably in the early 60s, young child in the early 60s, seeing that coming together of that, and then later on seeing an explosion by the late 60s, early 70s, and a real explosion of what we call conscious music in Jamaica.
Well, I know the album that you make reference to, and of course, I don't think Bob Bandy has gotten his due, because Bob Bandy is really an incredible writer of music.
I would argue that he's probably, if you have three of the top 10 writers, he's in the top three.
Yeah,
I call him arguably the best writer Jamaica ever.
And you know, the fascinating thing about Bob Bandy is that tune, I've Got to Go Back Home, in terms of the diaspora. When the dance of music started, and I don't mean dancehall, but when basement dances started in New York, in early 60s. That was a song that once it played, everybody got up and danced, and everybody sang to the song because it sort of touched the nerve of people who had traveled abroad to make a living, but they knew they still had that umbilical cord attachment to the motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that is personified in Bob Andy's music. Now, Bob made some great music, even with Marcy Griffiths.
I'll mention one particular song that stands out in my mind, Unchained Melody. Just take these chains away and set me free. Release me out of bondage and we'll all agree. Too long I've been a slave, don't want to be no more. I would rather dig my grave than be locked behind a door. Yeah. I want to help myself to be an independent man. I don't want no one to give me an helping hand.
Yeah.
And there's another song that said, I need nothing to be a man. I was born a man. And I deserve the right to live like a man. Now, when you think of all of that, I'm going to tell you why it sticks in my mind, Basil. While I was doing political science in the 80s at City College, mm-hmm. that particular line about me nothing to be a man, born a man, the question of inalienable natural right that you're born with to your humanity, that song kind of just popped into my head in one of my political science classes when I was doing my degree. And I'm saying, here you have it in popular music form, yes, but it was almost as if I'm seeing in writing, in political treaties, something that somebody was expressing in song about being that you're not inferior, you were born with these rights. And I think that, for me as a child, kind of shaped a whole lot of what I saw while I was doing political.
And, you know, it's a damn shame that I don't think anybody has really developed a full-length documentary on Bob Andy. And Bob Andy has been a pioneer in the music. You know, I've only met him perfunctorily. I really don't have a much longer discussion with him. But, you know, you can see the profoundness of his music and how astute he is in understanding the culture and his own humanity. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done.
I've had the pleasure of interviewing him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, after that interview back in the 80s, I came to the conclusion that he's probably Jamaica's greatest songwriter, arguably. And the reason I say this is that he writes love songs just as well as he writes those kinds of songs and everything in between. And you're right. I think this is somebody that I would love to see a lot of other people and new listeners out there. If you get a chance, go pick up that album and just listen carefully to that album. It's called Songbook by Bob Andy. Because what has happened to some extent is that we become the Marley generation, and everybody thinks it starts with Marley. And one of the things I've been arguing is that Marley is the end product of a whole process that he was involved in. Rastafari, yes, but musically, where people are making similar music to what he and the Wailers ended up making, which is a big part of why that explosion took place. And I think people need to understand that, because for a young man like me, looking at things, it was about an identity, who you were, or how do you place in society, where your place is in society, that kind of thing. So I think it's important to understand that. Now,
but
we looked at the role.
Something important, Sam, in the sense that, you know, when the music started, the landscape was limited to Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's maybe some records went to people who went abroad, but essentially it was musicians speaking to the larger Jamaican society. But I think what is fascinating in terms of this transition, and I think it sort of tells you a lot about a plantation economy, about a colonial society, about independent Jamaica. I think the musicians recognized that you couldn't really accumulate capital by just limiting oneself to the internal market. That to survive and to accumulate capital in the 20th century, you had to tap into an export market. And there are a number of people like Prince Buster, in terms of the Blue Beat, who went to England and started this, having an export brand and, you know, having an export connection. But there are some others, like Marley, who just took the music to another level and made it part of globalization. And that is why it is how the reggae musician, Jamaican musician, who really had talent was able now to become a worldwide phenomenon rather than just limiting oneself to the Jamaican landscape.
I want to flip back a bit because we're moving in a progression and look at Rocksteady. Now, Beres Hammond and Muta Baruka, in interviews I've done with them, have said that is the greatest music Jamaica has ever produced. It is the shortest period because it only lasted for 2 years. But they have argued that that is the era when Jamaica produced the most complete music because it had, and I'm not arguing for it or against it, that it was more complete in that there was harmonies, vocals, and there was rhythmically there was a more developed form of music, not the stripped down minimalist that we get with say One Drop. So can you tell us a little bit about how the transition from ska to rocksteady and what was rocksteady? Can you touch on that?
Remember, a lot of the music in Jamaica came out of studio music, right? In the sense mm-hmm. that and studio musicians were always experimenting. I think that music tends to have an impact for a certain time. And I mean, you mm-hmm. know, I would argue that ska music also represents a high point in our creativity in terms of the music made by the Scatterlights. But I think in mm-hmm. some respects, the rocksteady music really now became congruent with the tempo of Jamaican life. I think that's the beauty of the music, right? Here, ska is a quick rhythm. You know, where one mm-hmm. moves and it's shuffling and dancing and, you know, if you see a Persian cat at work and, you know, needles.
Yeah, on a castro.
Right. So that music was made for that kind of dancing. The rocksteady really becomes, in a sense, love music. It sort of mm-hmm. becomes congruent with a tropical society where you can be moving at 100 miles an hour. And it is true. I mean, you know, there's some of the groups that emerge for rocksteady, like the Paragons, Leroy Sibless's group,
the Heptones.
There's just a lot of classics that came out of that genre, you know. And I think it is not unusual for music to constantly begin to find a new beat or a new thrust, in the sense that that is the essence of the musical tradition, that you don't just stay within one genre, but you're constantly exploring. In fact, great musicians tend to move along a different route whenever they sometimes make a new album. They're always exploring, always experimenting. So the rocksteady, you know, really represented a new Jamaica. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. a Jamaica that was now independent, that was now, in fact, you know, discovering its own rhythm. And, you know, there's a beauty to rocksteady. But the rocksteady music, I wouldn't say, personifies protest music. It really more is a celebration.
I will agree with you on that, because when I think of Alton Ellis, who is Mr. Rocksteady, Ken Booth, the King of Rocksteady,
yes.
Ken Booth, Lady with the Starlight, to me, right. would be right. the prototype rocksteady tune. Or as Upton Lewis, my good friend, who they say his tune, Take It Easy, was
Take
the first
right.
rocksteady right. tune. And I specifically asked him this question, how did that come about? And he said it was purely by accident. They were in the studio trying to record the song, and they couldn't get the beat right. And Lynn Tate, who's from Trinidad, said to them, you have calypso. You have fast calypso, and you have slow calypso. Why don't we try a slow calypso beat to this tune? So this ba-ba-da-bum-bum, that's what that was. And just in the turn of a phrase, you had the music sort of shift with that. And you're right that, but then how did we move? Because rocksteady was a pretty brief period. It was it's the shortest period of any Jamaican genre.
Yeah, but ska didn't really last that long.
It lasted 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, well, the Scatterlights lasted less than a year, but you know, ska might have lasted.
But ska took hold. But as we said earlier, ska in some respects was sort of a celebratory music for a people, even independent, so we're celebrating.
It comes out of the rhythms. I mean, we listen to people like Brivet and Nibs, you know, they were the ones who really played that rhythm section. And, in a sense, you know, I think the beauty of ska is that it allows a jazz-like musical expression within a dance form. Because people like Tommy McCook really define themselves as jazz musicians, you know. They played dance music, but if you listen to their riffs, they were really jazz musicians. And so I think the musical form of ska allowed itself to embrace that kind of jazz rhythms and that kind of, you know, creativity. Whereas rocksteady was somewhat more sedate. I mean, if you take a chorus rocksteady, it's a little different from a chorus in ska music.
No, then. I mean, the big jump then is how do we move from, we figured out how we move from ska to rocksteady. Because obviously, on the political front, and we always have to be looking at that, the political and economic front, independence had not, after 10 years, brought the fruits that the majority of Jamaicans expected. So there was a level of disillusionment. And I would argue that it is probably one of the reasons why rocksteady did not last, because people were not as easygoing and life was, people were beginning to become disillusioned. And somehow we made this move to reggae, roots reggae, by the time we got to be about 1970. Talk a little bit about how that, because it became almost like a coherent ideology. Because let me go back a bit. Jamaican music was always popular outside of Jamaica in that we always had Jamaican singers who had hits abroad in Great Britain and some in Holland, the Tony Gregorys, the Ken Parkers, all had songs that were charting. So before there was a Marley explosion, and a lot of people think Jamaican music became popular with them. It was, as you said earlier, Bob and Martha Griffith, Young Griffith, Gifted and Black, and a number of other people, Desmond Decker, poor Israelite that charted in the United States, and Liquidator with Harry J. also, and Dave and Ansel Collins. So it was always there. But we got to a period where there seemed to have been an ideological approach to music, or in moral, social. I don't know. Maybe you as a political scientist can describe it better than I do. But it changed the dynamic of the music. It changed the feel, the sound, and the dynamic. Could you talk a little bit about that?
You make reference to the roots nature of the music. I think one of the things that begins to happen in reggae music, as well as, you know, this roots-like music, is that people are moving more into where they are in terms of African retentions, in terms of their lifestyle, and as a result, a new form comes into being. I'm thinking of groups like Culture, Burning Spear, a lot of groups.
Gladiators.
A lot of groups emerged then, Ethiopians, etc.
Right.
That, to me, is an outgrowth of now this mass impact of Rastafari. Remember now, I think a crucial demarcation point is when Selassie comes to Jamaica in
66.
That is a serious demarcation point. And in fact, Rastafari spreads significantly after that. And I think you begin to see now that you know, how that is influencing the lyrics, the roots. You know, you have the origins in terms of Count Dazzy and Bunny and Skitter.
And Skitter.
Some of that early music. But in terms of that music integrating itself into the larger music in a sort of penetrating way, I think that might have taken place after 66. And the coming of Il Selassie the widespread influence of Rastafari, and I think that began to penetrate the studios, and in fact,
my question is this, Basil.
Yeah,
the coming of Selassie, was that sort of the burgeoning of Rastafari to the more the forefront of Jamaican society? Did that embolden them a lot more than before?
The scale, I think the scale and the legitimacy increases sizably after 66, in the sense that, you know, shortly after, I'd say that's the high point of Rastafari. I think that carries over into the 1970s. It begins to decline shortly, maybe after the death of Selassie, maybe in the early 80s. But dreadlocks became not something that was a rarity. It became something that people wore as an expression. Because one of the things that emerges, most musicians started, being dreadlocks. So, in a sense, not just Rastafari as a religion, but Rasta as a culture started to permeate the music and have that enormous impact, in terms of weed smoking, in terms of, the worldview, etc. And you see that expressed in the lyrics, in the musical forms that come into being.
And you're listening to Blog Talk Radio, The Keys 107. And this is State of Affairs with Stan Smith, and I'm talking to distinguished host, guest, Dr. Basil Wilson, and we're looking at the impact of music on the Jamaican music on the diaspora and self-identity and the development of the music. And for those of you listening out there on the World Wide Web, you can call in if you have any questions or comments, 646-716-5971. That's 646-716-5971, and you just simply press the pound key on one, and our engineer will put you through. Now let's move.
I just want to accentuate something that you mentioned. I think it has to do with this question of identity, and I think you also mentioned before how times were becoming difficult because you enter independence with a certain euphoria. But once the migration became more difficult, especially to Britain, that came to a halt essentially, it meant that a lot of the urban areas became a bottleneck. And so that became a sort of identity crisis where people had to find ways to express themselves and to begin to define themselves within the social structure of Jamaican society. And this is where the Rasta influence become terribly significant. But there are other competing influences. There's also a rise in tribalism in terms of the respective political parties, a rise in political violence that accompanied some of the ideological conflicts in the late 60s and early 70s, and in fact, throughout the 70s. So in a sense that there are different streams, but I think that the Rasta movement develops its own autonomy and is in fact very influential in terms of the music.
Let me ask you this, because you mentioned migration. Was there any point where there was a migration from rural Jamaica, the country areas, into Kingston at a certain point?
from the post-emancipation period. One of the things that we see is that...
And did it become a bottleneck at a certain point where overrun?
Yeah, one of the things that is happening is the crisis of land ownership. As the population begins to increase in the late 19th century, you find that people could not make a living from the land, and so they tended to migrate to the towns and to the cities. By the time you begin to get the early industrialization, people gravitate to the cities, especially Kingston, because...
Stick up in Basil, so that people understand what you're talking about. because people know trench tone. What Basil is referring to now is the burgeoning of a trench tone and a Jonestown, those areas. Continue. I just
right.
just wanted to put
yeah,
that
because,
in there.
So what I'm getting now is that as people gravitate to the cities, they're looking for jobs, but there are not as many jobs being created as there are people seeking jobs. So you get a surplus labor problem. So one of the things that emerges, you find a multiplicity of shanty towns begin
mm-hmm.
to emerge, shacks and you know people living in dehumanized conditions. But that had a lot to do with the population increase, the inability of the countryside to absorb that population, and the gravitation
mm-hmm.
to the city, which sets up a sort of social crisis within the society. And it finds a musical form in terms of the new forms that the music begins to take.
Now, so we're up to the 70s now, where the music is now seeing all of these social forces, social, political, and economic forces, impact on it, migration, politics, the whole works. Now, we're at a point where the music, the beat of the music changes, which is ironic. The beat, it is basically stripped down to a drum and bass. And, of course, we have to talk about King Tubby's and dub first before we even get to that, because that becomes important to how the music then evolves. But what I saw happening, and help me out here, Dr. Wilson, on this, is music began to, I wouldn't say be preaching, but it began to take on a tone that was expositing ideas of how one ought to live and what was wrong with society and how a moral tone as to how to correct it. And the music itself stripped itself away from most of the instrumentation that was around it and kept it basic. That's what I saw happening then.
But I think that has a lot to do with technology. I mean, there's also technological
mm-hmm.
breakthroughs occurring. And, you know, there's a multiplicity of studios coming into being. But I think one of the things that, you know, I mean, you know, religion is great. But often religion takes us into the realm of escapism.
Mm-hmm.
So religion can free the soul, and it can shape the identity, but it doesn't change social structure.
Okay.
And so one of the things that we're seeing in terms of Rastafari, yes, people embrace the identity and the black consciousness, etc., but it is not having a telling impact on the reality of their lives, because they are into the escapism. And one of the things that if you look at Jamaican religion, not just Rastafari, but even Christianity, you know, especially Christianity.
Fundamentalism.
Yes, fundamentalism. Especially Christianity coming out of inner city communities. It is about damnation. It is about hell. But it doesn't really deal with how do you change people's lives and improve people's material well-being. So that's one of the things that is missing at that time. Despite, remember now, there's tremendous conflict in the streets in the 70s because of Michael Manley's democratic socialism, because of Eddie Seaga's commitment.
Just stick up in, Basil, because we have to go to a commercial break here. Basil, hold your thought, because it's getting interesting. And we're going to go to a commercial break and pick it up. Basil, go get yourself so a nice cold thing or something to drink. We're going to pick it up right where you left off. So, ladies and gentlemen, as we say, we're going to a commercial break.
The Keys 107 is proud to present State of Affairs with your host, Sam Smith.
On your Blog Talk Radio, then your Blog Talk Radio isn't really on. Keys 107, in media partnership with Harlem's newest gym, the Miss Theater, proudly presents winner, best drama at UK's One World Media Awards, and double award winner at 2012 African Movie Academy Awards, Othello Burning, a beautiful coming-of-age drama, a gripping story of South African township kids as they discover surfing, a newfound freedom. Directed by award-winning filmmaker Sarah Bletcher, Othello Burning will open shortly at the Miss Theater in Harlem, located at 46 West 116th Street. For more information, visit World Wide Web, MissHarlem.com.
This portion of The Keys was brought to you by the Entrepreneurs of New York Incorporated, a virtual entrepreneurial service agency designed to increase productivity for small businesses operating and servicing urban communities worldwide. Remember, the Entrepreneurs of New York Incorporated, ENY. You can find us on Facebook.
This portion of The Keys was brought to us by Moon107.com. Moon107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Moon107 is an online retail store featuring women's and men's clothing and a gift shop. The woman's shop features stylish tunics, suits, and accessories, and offers the well-dressed woman an outlet to find the perfect gift for self or for someone else. The men's shop offers classy French cuffed shirts for the well-dressed man. The gift shop offers organic skin, hair, bath accessories, and inspirational music imported from Africa, India, and Asia, as well as jewelry and accessories. Moon 107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Don't forget to visit Moon107.com.
Moon107.
You really don't understand, do you? Hey, man, don't you realize in order for us to make this thing work, man, we've got to get rid of the pimps and the pushers and the prostitutes and then start all over again clean.
Hey, look, nobody's pushing me anyway, okay? I mean, not you, not the cops, nobody, man. I mean, you want to get rid of the pushers, I'll help you. But don't send your people after me.
Oh, come on, John. Can't you see that we can't get rid of one without getting rid of the other? We got to come down on both of them at the same time in order for this whole thing to work for the people.
Hey, look, nobody's closing me out of my business.
Because of serious economic times, there's been an increase of violence and crime. Most of its victims have been women and youth. There must be a collective effort for all of the grassroots organizations and social agencies to bring peace to these communities. Peace is the common denominator that allows us to transcend above religious, political, and racial differences. We also believe that peace is not just the absence of war or violence, but peace is the absence of conflict. All conflicts are not violent. We must work together as peacekeepers to eliminate these conflicts, to create an environment of peace. I am present for peace. www.thepeacekeepers.org.
Keys 107, in media partnership with Harlem's newest gem, the Miss Theater, are proud to present winner of 7 national and international film awards, Elsa, a film telling the universal story of a family in turmoil. A young woman's dream becomes an obsession in search for self, offering an insider's view of the lush island culture of Guadeloupe. Elsa is the first feature by a female director from this Caribbean island. Elsa opens shortly at the Mist Harlem, the newest venue for high-quality entertainment located at 46 West 116th Street. For ticket information on the World Wide Web, go to MistHarlem.com.
That very moment, elsewhere on the base, shimmering shape suddenly appears out of thin air. A shape that takes on human form, finally crystallizing into focus, revealing itself to be none other than
Stan Smith. As we return to State of Affairs.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen and audience on the World Wide Web, we're back. I hope Basil was able to wet his throat because he's been doing a lot of talking. And
I didn't drink any beers. I wanted to mention.
You didn't get a red stripe, right?
Nice sobriety.
Okay, now we understand there may be a bit of a problem with the calling number. So we're going to give you out there in the World Wide Web a number you can call. It's 213-943-3618. And, of course, you just push. It'll prompt you to push 1. And our engineer will put you through if you have any questions or comments. Now, we're at Basil was at a point where it was bubbling, where he got to Michael Manley's socialism and the rest. Basil, I'm going to let you take the lead again and move on with that. What you're talking about?
Well, this is the body politic now, in the sense that by the time he got to the late 60s, early 70s, you're seeing the manifestation of a society in crisis in terms of the ratchet knife, in terms of increasing violent crime, in terms of maldistribution of wealth, and certainly concentration of poverty. So one of the things that happened is an attempt now to reconstruct a society by Michael Manley's PNP in the form of democratic socialism. Rather than settling the class dialectic, it exacerbates it, and it creates a tremendous amount of conflict and Cold War shenanigans. And even though Michael Manley wins the election in 72, which I think that's the election that Theodore Wilson made the song Better Must Come.
Better Must Come, right.
Right. And in fact, right after he won, Michael Manley wins re-election in 76. The country is on the verge of bankruptcy, so they have to go to the International Monetary Fund. The fund, in a Philistine-like way, demands a stripping of any kind of social programs, lowering the standard of living of workers, so you get an increased immiseration of the working class. And, in fact, Michael Manley is kicked out of power in 1980, and Nelisiaga rides in with a white horse to make money jingle in people's pockets. Well, people had pockets, but the money didn't jingle. And but these were turbulent times in Jamaica, and in some respects, the music begins to reflect it.
Let's flip back for a second before you go down, and don't lose that thought, because we're always on the music. A big part of Michael Manley's success had to do with a lot of the musicians supporting him, like the Powerfall and I, Max Romeo, the caravans of artists who were traveling around the country in trucks performing for them. So they became also a part of it, did they not?
Yeah, but I think it represented hope for the masses, and that is manifested in terms of the music and the song. But remember now, development is an agonizing process, and it's not apocalyptic. It doesn't come overnight. And and plus, Jamaica is a fragile economy, very much dependent on tourism.
Tourism on bauxite.
Crisis of bauxite in terms of the downturn in the economy, increase in oil prices beginning in 1973 because of OPEC, et cetera, et cetera. So, in a sense, you remember there was a song called Everything Crash. Look,
right. Ethiopians, actually.
Ethiopians, right. And so there's also a disillusionment that comes about. So there was this great hope, and to some extent there's this crushing disillusionment, because the environment in which Manley is functioning is quite a hostile one. And, to balance these things, you have an entrepreneurial class which feels frightened by the changes, and, that's dysfunctional to the economy. And I think this is where I think modern music becomes terribly critical. Because I think modern music tends to capture what was taking place during this period, but he functioned outside of politics. You know? And so I think that vein in the society, which is identifying with, which is critical of the injustices of Babylon, et cetera, comes through in the form of Peter Tosh, Bonnie Wheeler, Bob Marley, and others.
Let me just remind the audience of some songs that came that reflect what Basil is talking about. Concrete Jungle, Dreamland, those kinds of songs, Have to Get a Beaten, Pound Get a Blow. Those are the kinds of songs that were coming out at that particular, and we're talking about, this is just Wailers alone. There are other people making songs, but I'm just talking about Peter, Bunny, and Bob right there, just to give people a flavor of what Basil is talking about as we keep it, bring it back to the music. Go ahead, continue, Basil.
Which is reflecting off the social crisis, off the economic crisis. The thing is, how do people survive in that kind of dialectic? How do people create their own space? And I think we have a fascinating issue here in terms of Marley in 76, where he decides to pay back the kind of embrace and solidarity that the Jamaican people have given to him. And so he's going to give a concert a week or two before the 76 election. And
you're talking about the Smile Jamaica concert now.
Smile Jamaica concert. And there's an attempt to assassinate Bob Marley. All right? Nobody has ever been brought to justice. There was no inquiry as to who ordered Bob Marley to be assassinated. But Marley is flown out of the country by Chris Blackwell and stays out of Jamaica, I think, for maybe 2 years until they
come
back with a peace concert. So I think all of that really has a profound impact on the music, because it shows you that the reggae musician had to create his or her own space in order not to get embroiled in the turbulent politics that became rampant in the late 70s. And part of that space is, in some respects, created by Rastafari. So you can denounce Babylon, but you don't have to take part in the tribal politics. But you are, in fact, sensitizing the population to the exploitation, to the injustices, to the inequities that are taking place within Jamaican society.
And that is really interesting, because as we look at how they sort of carved out a niche for themselves while being relevant and being a central actor in what's going on in Jamaica, the violence, because what we had was the hardening of lines, political lines, and entrenchment, and the violence, our people of the violence, and the clash, and the politics, and the, interestingly enough, and this I think is interesting to me, Basil, that they were able to carve out a space for themselves, and you did not have Bob Marley on the JLP side and Peter Tosh on the PMP side firing guns. They were able to somehow chart that course where they were able to look at that and realize exactly what it was, the divisive nature of it, and what it was doing to the society, and still remain being able to address it in their music. They obviously paid some price, because, like I said, Peter Tosh got beaten by the police within inches of his life, and assassination. And that assassination attempt on Bob was not the first one. So for those of you who don't know, there was an earlier one in before that. But what I'm arguing is that it is fascinating that these uneducated guys were sophisticated enough to figure out how to position themselves as messengers for trying to pull the people together around that things of their existence, even though they were being sucked into that vortex of politics. And I think that's a phenomenon that I think we that
right.
has caught my attention.
Yeah, I think it shows the new complexity of Jamaican society, and the new complexity of the music, and of a musician who is making the music. And I think Bob, but the interesting thing here is that there, as a result of some of these incidents, a peace movement emerges from below. You know, where sufferer communities recognize that this intra-class killing, you know, this killing feel of sufferer killing sufferer did not make any sense. And that's what brought about the peace movement, which in a sense developed its own dynamic independent of politicians. But, you know, and it manifests itself in terms of the peace concert, I think that took place in April of 78. But it just wasn't, it didn't have its own autonomy to the point where it could sustain the electoral process which came about in 1980. And by that time, the peace had collapsed and the tribalism was now reigning predominant. You know, but the musician tended to create his or her own space in order not to be devoured by the kind of large scale violence taking place in the late 70s and in the early 1980s. But I think what we see is that with the collapse of the attempts to make corrections in the society and the disillusionment that sets in, you get a certain disillusionment within the culture itself.
I think there's also another component there where what allowed the musicians some room or sort of a release valve is that the music had now gone abroad.
Yes.
Marley and his company had taken it abroad. So they, in some respects, they were not in the pressure cooker having to survive within that and make some of the choices that some of the young people there who did not have those options had to make in terms of whether you went bust gun for a politician or whatever, and you had to you had your gang and you have your borderline and the rest of it. A lot of the musicians, because they had that release valve of traveling, and we look at what the traveling meant and what the message they brought a little bit further down in the program, but just that release valve, I think, was helpful to them to give them some breathing space that they were able to more to operate a little bit more independently in terms of seeing what was actually taking place and addressing it from a perspective.
And I think most significant, as the music, at least in the initial stages, becomes globalized, a lot of folks are, in fact, gravitate to the music because it represents a certain level of consciousness. You know, the impact that Marley's music had on Zimbabwe and the African freedom movement is not happenstance. It has to do with the lyrics. It has to do with what he represented. I mean, when Marley began to draw huge crowds throughout Europe, it had a lot to do with what his music represented. And so there's a whole new generation that sees the virtue and the enlightenment coming from that kind of music. So in a sense, the music not only became globalized, but it began to sort of touch on the humanity that became essential in a world of accelerated globalization.
Let me do two things here, just for some color commentary. By 79, the Wailers, according to Rolling Stone magazine, was the most popular band in popular music, not in reggae music, in popular music. Marley, by that time, had pretty much broken all of Elvis Presley and the Beatles' attendance records in Europe. And from what I was told by people within his group, he was almost booked out for the next 3 years. That's how big he was, and just as an act, traveling the world. But I think the key piece that Basil touched on just now was the message of the music. Because, like I said, they had the breathing space, but they also traveled. And I think one of the things that happened with Marley, for me, is that when he left Jamaica, a lot of what he was taught, a lot of what he learned from the Rasta movement and the consciousness movement within the music, he began to see a lot of it outside of Jamaica that validated the things that he had learned and some of the conclusions he had come to about the global nature of the oppressive Babylon system, as he called it, as he referred to it in his music, at work. And it wasn't just Jamaica. It was a global phenomenon. So I think in some respects they flipped it and decided that maybe Rasta and reggae needed to start to give an alternative to a better humanity.
But you described it
in one of your articles as something about the creeping acquisition of wealth or something. I don't remember, but you're saying basically it was the capitalism was they were really addressing the ugly features of capitalism.
Right.
And of accumulation.
Yeah, but I think the interesting dialectic then is that as the music became globalized and commercialized and brought about capital accumulation, Marley wanted to remain in control of his music when he toured, when he did not tour. Okay, remember now, there's pressure on him to just tour. And touring takes a lot out of you. So,
exactly.
I mean, during that period, Bob wanted to say, listen, I will tell you when I go on tour, not you tell me when I am to go on tour. And I think that's an important autonomy that he wanted to establish for himself. Because one of the things that you see in terms of music is how music, at least how promoters, can destroy musicians. You know, in some respects, you know, you look at a Michael Jackson, a Whitney Houston, that you can become so preoccupied, so obsessed with the bright lights that you destroy your own temple, you destroy your own health, and you just, in fact, fall apart in no time. And one of the things that Marley was very much conscious of is that he wanted to be in control of not just his own music, but when he went on tour, because he knew the toll that touring took on the human body.
As somebody who has been in the music industry for a while, I'll tell you what that is. You become a commodity, a money-making commodity, attracting money-making commodity, because the discussions around tours is how much money people are going to lose. I'll give you an example. The late Gregory Isaacs, up until the point of when he was going to die, got a call from London saying he was really in bad shape way before it became public. And there was discussion among people about whether or not you take him on the road and have him sit on a stool and sing. So you get a sense of what I'm talking about, in that people want, you become a money-making machine for people, and they don't care about you as an individual. So I think that's why Marley's stance is so important. And I don't think a lot of people understand it, and I'm glad you brought it up, Basil, because people need to understand that you've got to, as one singer said, rule your internal in terms of how you move.
I think it was
one of his songs said it, I rule our internal, that you had to let labels know and promoters know that, look, you're not going to wear this out so that you can make a whole bunch of money and I drop dead.
Well, it's interesting really looking at how the Wailers dealt with this. Because remember, Bunny decided that he wouldn't tour.
Mm-hmm.
And even after Marley died, Bunny was reluctant to tour.
Right.
In fact, when Bunny opted to tour, I think his time had passed. Peter, recognized that he could make it on his own and went on tour. But also shortly before, when Peter died, he was just about to go back on tour because he was having some health problems. But it shows that these people wanted to interface with the world on their terms rather than allowing the world to dictate to them. You could call that musical self-determination.
But let me make an ancillary point to that. In terms of cultural identity, you remember, we're slaves coming back where we were told when to come, when to go, when to sleep, when to eat. And our identity and our struggle is always for an autonomy and the ability to say, as Marley says, my life. I must say, I want to do this, I don't want to do this, I like this, I don't like that, to quote him. But it comes back to that, that seminal question of autonomy of self, and when do you move and when you not move, as opposed to being told and put as what Marley called a treadmill where you just move. They put you on it and they just kept you moving.
Right.
So you're absolutely right.
But that timing is also terribly important in music. A touring becomes terribly important in expanding.
But you as an artist also understand when your time has come. Because you, believe me, when you're on that stage, I remember Chris Blackwell saying at that Lyceum show in 1975, what he saw in there, he and Bob came to the conclusion, you are going to be a major star. So he knew that was his time. And he, but the modalities of how it operated,
precisely.
I think what you're talking
is when
he had the injuries to his toe and they still wanted to keep the tour going.
Yes.
You know, that kind of thing. I mean, it goes to those questions of other people than pulling your strings.
Right. I think Michael Jackson, a classical example, where he was going to embark on a 50-performance
tour
where he failed to survive that.
At age 50. And it wasn't a drawn-out tour for a whole year. It was in a condensed period.
Yeah.
Given the level of his performance, he wouldn't have been able to carry it on.
And so, you know, one of the things that we see about the world of music is that there's an enormous amount of tragedy that surrounds the world of music. And I think much of that tragedy has a lot to do with when musicians allow non-musicians to determine their lives. Because a musician has to know what is his capacity when, you know, when he reaches a breaking point or does not reach a breaking point. And that's where a lot of musicians then become dependent on drugs, which after a while begin to destroy their temple. You know, the whole thing of drugs and music is something that we have to completely understand it and how destructive it is to the musician and to the artist.
Okay, we're going to stick a pin again as we go to a commercial break. And again, for you folks, before we go to the break, if you have any comments or questions for Dr. Wilson or myself, you can call 213-943-3618. And, of course, the prompt will tell you to push 1. Again, the number is 213-943-3618. So we're going straight to a commercial and we come back on the other side.
The Keys 107 is proud to present State of Affairs with your host, Sam Smith. Of the Keys was brought to you by Rafika Consultants and Services LLC. For the best consultants and services around, make sure you find us on the web, RCS LLC. You're listening to the Keys on Blog Talk Radio.
Keys 107 in media partnership with Harlem's newest gem, the Mix Theater, are proud to present winner of 7 national and international film awards, Elsa, a film telling the universal story of a family in turmoil. A young woman's dream becomes an obsession in search for self, offering an insider's view of the lush island culture of Guadeloupe. Elsa is the first feature by a female director from this Caribbean island. Elsa opens shortly at the Mist Harlem, the newest venue for high-quality entertainment located at 46 West 116th Street. For ticket information on the World Wide Web, go to mistharlem.com.
the Keys Network is proud to present live from Harlem, USA, The Communicators with your host, Brother Leroy, every Saturday at 7 p.m. following The Keys on Blog Talk Radio. Never forget The Keys, opening doors to endless possibilities.
Keys 107 in media partnership with Harlem's newest gem, the Miss Theater, are proud to present winner of 7 national and international film awards, Elsa, a film telling the universal story of a family in turmoil. A young woman's dream becomes an obsession in search for self, offering an insider's view of the lush island culture of Guadeloupe. Elsa is the first feature by a female director from this Caribbean island. Elsa opens shortly at the Mist Harlem, the newest venue for high-quality entertainment located at 46 West 116th Street. For ticket information on the World Wide Web, go to mistharlem.com.
M-A-U-N-1-0-7. This portion of The Key was brought to us by Moon107.com. Moon107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Moon 107 is an online retail store featuring women's and men's clothing and a gift shop. The woman's shop features stylish tunics, suits, and accessories and offers the well-dressed woman an outlet to find the perfect gift for self or for someone else. The men's shop offers classy French cuffed shirts for the well-dressed man. The gift shop offers organic skin, hair, bath accessories, and inspirational music imported from Africa, India, and Asia, as well as jewelry and accessories. Moon 107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Don't forget to visit Moon107.com.
M-A-U-N-107.
That very moment, elsewhere on the base, a shimmering shape suddenly appears out of thin air, a shape that takes on human form, finally crystallizing into focus, revealing itself to be none other than
Stan Smith, as we return to State of Affairs.
Yes, again, Stan Smith here along with Dr. Basil Wilson, as we look at the impact of Jamaican music on the diaspora and questions of identity, and now he's introduced the concept of autonomy, which is critical to identity. Now, the final half of our program is going to look at when the music left Jamaica and what the impact was. Basil touched on some of it in terms of Zimbabwe and the importance of Bob's music on Zimbabwe and South Africa, and Peter Tosh. And I'm just going to set up a backstory, the backstory first before I can let Basil get in on it. I did 4 or 5 specials on Peter Tosh on WBA on my Reggae Roundtable in New York between 1994 and 2005. And one of the things that came out in that special was the fact that the question of apartheid, which while I was in high school was hotly discussed among the intelligentsia and high school kids and all of us, is that Peter Tosh brought the word into the recording studio. And according to Sly Dunbar, as early as 71, 72, Tosh was talking about apartheid, and they felt that it was a word he had made up because nobody in the music community knew anything about it. And Peter was talking about it. He had read the book, The Border Band, and according to Herbie Miller, when he read it, about the beheading of Africans, a way of showing that you kill an African when it was to cut his head off and to take it to the Italian and all the rest of that. Peter had a sort of a very good working knowledge of it, hence the album Mikor Writes. So the whole question of the international struggle of things like apartheid was prevalent in Jamaican music. Now, Basil, with that as a backstory coming forward, could you talk a little bit about when the music really left the shores in terms of its message and what you were talking about earlier in terms of capturing the imagination of the world?
Well, I think that started in the late 70s. I mean, one of the things that you have to recognize is that the diaspora in Canada, in the United States, and in Britain was very much into the music. You know, they, in many respects, served as the ambassadors to the music. I mean, there were music stores that emerged in Brooklyn, Queens, Brixton, elsewhere. So they were really the first repositories for this export process that started, with Millie Small from the late 1960s, et cetera,
Well, Basil, let me put a plug for my dad, because he's the first person to help teach Mr. Dodd printing of, helping him get a printing press and printing those labels. But what he did when he lived in Washington, he used to bring Mr. Dodd's records to the record stores here in Washington, D.C. So just to bring
right.
that.
Yeah.
To,
And by the time you get to the 70s now, we have this new phenomenon, international tours, because the music has had an impact on Japan, throughout the United States. I mean, you know, remember, though, you had ska bands, even when the Scatolites didn't exist, that came up in certain parts of the Midwest, etc. So the key thing was to go on tour. And once you were on tour, it meant then you could, in fact, bring that message to larger and larger numbers of people. And it also meant that the reggae artist was freed from the limitations of just making a living within Jamaica. So the international music tour, you know, whether it was Bob Marley's tour, Bonnie Wheeler, even some of the older artists began to find a niche market in Europe. Incidentally, somebody like Johnny Moore. You know, when Johnny Moore was an integral part of the Scatolites. When Johnny Moore started making music on his own, one of the things that helped Johnny Moore in his later life was that he used to go to Paris every summer to play, which gave him a certain amount of money, which enabled him to build a house in Red Hills, which was almost finished before he died. So they were able to establish niche markets based upon this internationalization of the music. So the touring became a lifeline, and so it helped to spread the message in such a way that you didn't really have a political movement connected to it or a mass peace movement as such. The music was far more variegated than that. But there's no question that the messaging of the music had a profound impact on the people who gravitated to the music.
Mm-hmm. No, in terms of, let's get specific here, because we think of Bob Marley's survival album in 79, specifically looking at African liberation. Prior to Marley, Marcus Garvey was the big influence on the decolonization movement. Now, you had between 1973 and 1980, you had about 13 social revolutions taking place. And at that point, the world was again, the political landscape was in transition.
No.
We had a transitional period when the decolonization period.
Yeah, but let me mention, it's not just Marcus Garvey. You had George Padmore.
More,
you had a profound
the Niagara movement.
T.L.R. James, W.B. Du Bois. I mean, all of these people were Pan-Africanists. I mean, Du Bois played a sterling role in keeping the Pan-African movement alive, keeping these conferences, and revealing and educating folks that colonialism was about the business of dehumanizing people. So, I mean, you have this tremendous decolonization that took place in Africa. But with Zimbabwe was belated because he had a large concentration of whites in Rhodesia at the time, and they didn't want to to decolonize. They didn't want to, Africans to have self-determination. The same situation in South Africa. So that took on a particular dynamic for not only Bob Marley, but for Jamaican musicians. That became a rite of passage. I mean, we saw that as being important to the further development of Africa, that South Africa had to be free. And so when Nelson Mandela was emerged from prison and you had the democratization of South Africa, I mean, there's no question that Marley's music, and also the same situation in Rhodesia, which became known as Zimbabwe, that music resonated in that part of the world, in the townships of South Africa, in the townships of Zimbabwe, because there were people coming out of Jamaican society who identified with their suffering and understood the need for them to bring about their own liberation. So it's interesting. Go ahead, sir.
Now, this question might seem a bit obvious, but I'm going to ask it anyhow. How did Jamaicans stay all the way halfway across the world and figure out that the liberation of Africa meant something to them?
Because had a strong Pan-African sentiment within Jamaican society. This is the Garvey influence. This is the Rastafarian influence. This is the Ethiopian World Federation. There were always organized entities within Jamaican society that saluted and recognized the importance of Africa, even in terms of somebody, even within the body politic. I mean, if you looked at how Jamaica voted in the United Nations, the stance that it took, it showed solidarity with the African continent. We knew that the freedom of Africa was tied up with the freedom of black people everywhere.
But how did it work its way into the music? I remember Michael Manley clearly having this conversation with Henry Kissinger. We supported Agostinho Neto,
in Angola.
And in Mozambique, it was Simora Michelle. And I remember Kissinger coming to Jamaica and telling him that support was to be withdrawn and all the rest of that.
Right.
But that is to be expected. That's the political realm. Michael Manley had taken a particular political stance with respect to neocolonialism and imperialism. How then did it make its way into the music? Because the musicians were not necessarily politicians. How does that connection come about?
That, to me, is the Rastafarian connection. That is, remember now, the music is a form of cultural resistance. Rastafari. It was a form of cultural resistance. And so, therefore, there was a lot of discussion in Jamaica in the 19th century regarding the barbarism that continued to prevail in Africa in terms of apartheid or in terms of the Smith regime in Rhodesia. So there was both identification with it and a recognition that the musician could play a role in promoting that kind of humanization that was needed in Africa. And so it is a grassroots movement. It is not a university movement. It's a grassroots movement that comes out of the bowels of Jamaican society, of inner city communities, which recognize the need to identify with those other parts of humanity which were oppressed.
Now, let's look at Marley, Tosh, Whirlers, Spear, and everybody. They sort of had the 70s from the 76 on up to about the mid-80s. And then, of course, it spilled over into Great Britain with Steel Pulse, Aswad, and LKJ. Somebody like LKJ, Lincoln Crazy Johnson.
Lincoln Crazy, yeah.
And what we find happening is that there is a coming together of both class and race issues in the diaspora. And
yes.
Reggae being at the front.
Yeah. I mean, when I hear this, the person who I think was really the pioneer in this regard is Paul Robeson. Because Robeson, as an artist, stood for principle and also identified the Pan-Africanism to the point that he was persecuted in the United States. Harry Belafonte is somebody who was influenced by Robeson, but also took the same principled position in terms of linking music to struggle. So there's a long history of that in the black world, as well as other racial musical expressions. But in terms of the historical root of it, you can trace it right back to Garvey, coming right up to the Pan-African movement, right up to inner-city communities, right up to Rastafari, right up to Count Ozzie and the Mystic Revelation of the influence of Mortimer Piano. Remember, though, there was a mission to Africa that left Jamaica in the 1960s, which included
64 mission.
Yeah, so the whole business of Pan-Africanism was always present in the Jamaican body politic. It was omnipresent, and people were always concerned with apartheid and how brothers living in Africa were being treated by the colonialists.
No, my other question, Basil, the state of reggae obviously was at the forefront. It is a music that in some ways, and I've written a number of pieces on this, suggesting that it sort of made poverty and oppression. When I was doing political science, I heard about a rising tide lifts all boats and a whole bunch of trickle down kind of thing. And I remember at a certain point, things began to change where poverty was not looked at as people being their lot in life, but the questions of redistribution and poverty outside of the Marxist school began to become what forefront and discussions at dinner table and the inhumanity of man to man. And even the Pope started talking about the harsher features of capitalism. So I think what happens now, as I saw it, was that debate started to open up in different ways of looking at these kinds of oppression and how
and
to
the United Nations has established Manelio goals, which is an attempt to reduce the level of poverty throughout the world. But I think we have moved, with globalization, I think we have moved away from some of these high-minded objectives. I mean, if you take American society, I mean, from about 1973, you have had this growing inequality. And it's not even a discussion within the present American body politic. we might talk about tax, how people at the 2% or 1% are to be taxed. But there's something far more fundamental that the wealth that has been created from the 1970s has gone predominantly to the very few and the very rich. And so we don't have a music or a cultural tradition that has emerged really sensitizing us and to really, finding corrective measures for that kind of dastardliness. I mean, there was a time when we had a war on poverty in this country. There was a time when poverty in Jamaica was, in fact, going down. But I think in many respects, the juggernautish nature of globalization and the fact that it takes new techniques to really stand up to globalization and the fact that we have the informational technology to do it, we have not really found the political wherewithal to really beat back this sort of dehumanization that has taken hold of modern civilization.
And with that, I think we're coming to a close of our program today, and we've had a lot to chew on and a lot to think about. And Dr. Wilson, are there any closing remarks you would have in terms of the music itself and the role you probably think it ought to be playing, or what would be the next phase of the music in terms of addressing just what you were just talking about?
The thing that concerns me the most is that the unexamined life is not worth living. And one of the things that I'd like to see more of in terms of Jamaican music is not just the musician, but a cadre of people who write about the music in a critical way to sort of get the music back to its messaging. You know, one of the things that we have seen is that, you know, the music now begins to reflect some of the weaknesses of the mass culture. And that, to me, has a lot to do with living this unexamined life. And I think that music has an important role to play in humanizing us, in keeping the peace, in reducing the level of killing fields that take place in the society. And so we have moved away from the essence of that music. And I think that is the diamond nature of the musical contribution that we have made to world society. And we need to sort of find our way back in such a way that we can contribute to the peacemaking of Jamaican society and also contribute to the peacemaking in the larger world.
And with that said, Dr. Wilson, I would like to again thank you very much for being our guest today on State of Affairs as we look at the issue of music and culture and the diaspora and Jamaican music. I thank you very much. And
thank you,
of course, I know I'll be calling on you at a future point. So thank you very much. And Stan Smith here saying some people we want to give thanks to. Our producers and engineer, of course, Brother Forrest, Brother James, our Brother Jason, and Sister Rafika. And for those, I think I have a few things I have to say. Next week's show, we'll be looking somewhat at the music, but what we're going to do is actually use the music itself of the artists such as Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Burning Spear, Bob Andy, Carl Dawkins, Steel Pulse, Oswald, LKJ, and Muta Baruka, and just try to make sense of all of that we just talked about. We're going to hear actually how all of that comes together in the music and how it propelled it. So again, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Wilson, and I'd like to thank you on the World Wide Web for listening, and tune in next week, Saturday from 4 to 6, right here on The Keys 107 Blog Talk Radio. Stan Smith here, turning it over to our engineer as we close out. Thank you again.
The Keys 107 is proud to present State of Affairs with your host, Stan Smith.
120 years ago, freedmen became lawmen. Independent communities were built. Businesses, schools, people were thriving. Until organized destruction ensued. Fires, murder, violence, poverty, disease. All seemed lost. A community of people barely alive. Fast forward the year 2012. Technology. We have the capability to make the world's first conglomerate of organized, united community. The black community will be that force. Better than before. Better, stronger, united. Black Reconstruction. With your co-hosts, Sister LaShawn Allen Muhammad and Brother Malik Green.